Look, the reality is a sustainable future and a sustainable world will not be possible without the resources, and it will not be possible without a change in a mentality and a change in our understanding of which resources to use for what, particularly when it comes to energy, right? If we want to get out of fossil fuels and we want to decarbonize our energy systems, we need to get innovative with how we produce renewable energies. And they've got to become just as efficient, if not more, which they are capable of, but we've got to work on it, right? And so this is where science and what I call institutions, which is these mega organizations like country states or organizations such as the United Nations, which influence the policy landscape of how we conceptualize renewable energy and the transition to a just energy future. Now, today's guest, Mkhululi Ncube, is a programs officer at the African Minerals Development Center at the African Union. Okay, so he's been a big part of developing the Africa Mining Vision Action Plan and the African Green Minerals Strategy. Okay, he's got a background, he's got a global background, and I think he's bringing that to the ground. He's got a background in the United Nations Economic Commission for Africa. He's worked at the UNDP, that's the United Nations Development Program. He's worked at the Development Policy Management Forum, right? And all of his work covered this issue of natural resources. Now, I had the pleasure of co-chairing a session on quote-unquote critical minerals with Mkhululi, and I saw his ability to withstand division within a room and polarization, which you know is something that is very important for us nowadays, something that we need to master. Now, why do I say this? It's because people have different views of the minerals we need to store renewable energy, to transmit renewable energy, and to play a part in the generation of renewable energy. And there's been a debate about should we call them critical minerals or transition minerals, right? Should we call them critical because they're critical to making money, they're critical to economies, or they're critical to national, international security, which is a fear-based mentality? Or should we call them transition minerals, which is future-oriented and based in raw science, right? The transition minerals form the D block of the periodic table, and forgive me, all of you scientists who are listening, if I'm botching this, right? And they call transition minerals because they take us to the sustainable future. Now, I saw clearly hold the tension in the room. You can just imagine an intense room of people disagreeing: are these critical minerals or transition minerals? And being the co-chair, really, I saw Mkhululi hold the room and align us around the term green minerals. Like, so let's forget these other polarizing views, but let's agree that these minerals are green in the sense that they can create a green industrial future. So whether you're afraid of security or whether you're optimistic about sustainability, these minerals give us the green light, so as to say. Now, Mkhululi was an interesting guest, really an interesting guest to have, because his story is rooted in growing up as a cattle, or growing up in a cattle farming family, right? And as a kid, one of the things he asked himself is, where did my school shoes come from? Right? And in asking himself this, he realized that the community in which he was raised in and the family were not just cattle farmers in terms of making beef, right? But there was the production of beef, meat, and dairy, okay? But there was also hides or leather. Let me put it that way. I'm not an expert in this stuff, but hides and tanneries. So there was leather that could be produced for his school shoes. So the cattle had multiple uses, and he's arguing this with green minerals. And so today's conversation is both a technical and an institutional one, right? Looking at how our value chains, looking at how our governments, looking at how our intergovernmental institutions can help shape and grow jobs, can help shape and grow different businesses to alleviate poverty or to create new possibilities for people out there to expand the pool of prosperity. This is the idea. So looking at these minerals deeply, as if taking a microscope, actually turns out to being a kaleidoscope, let me say. It turns out to be a colorful vision of all the possibilities of green industrialization, good people. And recently, we just published a study that shows the possibilities here. Can you imagine that Africa has 60% of the world's best solar resources? 30% of these green minerals, or whether you like to call them critical or transitional, whatever, are located on the continent. And we have 25% of arable land. Now, if you take this reality and you consider it with this paradox, you will realize why this conversation with Mkululi is so vital. With all of this said, the continent receives less than 2.3% of clean energy or renewable energy investment. Only $15, okay? This is a $15 per capita investment that the continent captures. And less than 3% of renewable energy investment flows. Good people, if we're going to solve the world's problems, we need to get technical, we need to get scientific, and we need to look at the data. And a little bit more from around the world, if the world rallies around all the global regions that have these resources, we could make so much headway to solving this problem. And that's what Moku, aka Mkululi Ncube, shows us today. This is the reality that he shows us. An exciting one, good people. Exciting one. From the cow to the beef, to the milk, to the sausages, to the hides, and to the tannery that makes the leather, which made up his school shoes when he was just a kid. Welcome, Mkululi. Enjoy.
Welcome aboard our jet. The Just Energy Transition is a new podcast with the goal of amplifying the stories that matter most. Our mission? A Just Energy Transition, raising the voices of untold inspiring stories. At JET, we hope every listener becomes a true activist and every story a catalyst for real change.
Hi, Andani. How are you?
I'm strong. I'm solid. I'm calling you from out of Morocco. Where are you today?
I am in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, the proverbial capital of the continent.
Indeed, not proverbial. It is. It is the capital of the continent. World Economic Forums are hosted there. You, being at the AU, you are our host. So Addis is an amazing place to be. I went there. It was a very long time ago, but I enjoyed the taxi ride. I'm sure. Hey, man, I was on a roller coaster. But it functions.
It functions.
The roller function. But man, the driving was, I don't know, thrilling. Let me put it that way. Thrilling. A beautiful place to be. Now listen, Mkululi, you are at the AU. Before we go into the elephant in the room here, what do you do there? What does your work entail?
So I'm a programs officer at a specialized agency of the African Union called the African Minerals Development Center. It is tasked with implementing what is called the Africa Mining Vision. For those who don't know what the Africa Mining Vision is, in 2009, African heads of state acknowledged that it was time to have a developmental framework that pushes for equitable resource-based industrialization that is headlined by and underpinned by minerals and minerals development. So the issue of having gold in a country that doesn't have a golden lifestyle needs to come to a stop, right? We have a host of African countries that have multitudes of some of these minerals that are said to be critical for jurisdictions that are not even on the continent, and the lives of the citizens in those countries are none the better in terms of comparing where they should be and where they are. 2009, African heads of state were like, and it was after a while, this Africa Mining Vision document had been circulating, validated, done massive consultations across the continent. It was agreed that this is our document and framework to deshackle or decouple ourselves from poverty sitting next to mineral wealth. That was 2009, and for 5 years we celebrated, or for 4 years actually, we celebrated that this document was out there, but then it turned out there was a need for it to actually have a championing institution to get it done. That's how the African Minerals Development Center was born, and it was born at the United Nations Economic Commission for Africa, which is across town from where the Africa Union is, as a project, as a specialized project there. And then after its first phase, it was then handed over to the African Union as a fully fledged specialized agency. Well, I say fully fledged because at least now it's at its home. Fledged when the 15th African member state ratifies the AMDC statutes.
Mm-hmm.
We are at 4. But when it gets to 15, it then becomes fully fledged. We move to our home, our actual home base in Guinea-Conakry.
Mm-hmm.
But even before the 15 are signed, it's possible for us to get there. But those are all nitty-gritties that have to do with issues that are above my pay grade. So yeah,
I don't think so. I know you well enough. You have your fingers in every pot. But yes. Continue.
So yeah, so that is where I work right now. As we would say, we are an interim secretariat because we are not yet in Guinea-Conakry, where we will be said to be a fully fledged secretariat. But we're here. We are at the headquarters, the home base of the continent's Pan-Africanist institutions and sub-institutions. So we're here.
Power to the people, power to the people. You are truly a Pan-Africanist. You hail from Zimbabwe. You speak of Ethiopia, Addis. And now you're speaking of Guinea. When we met, you were in Morocco. How many countries on the continent
I think I should count how many countries I haven't been to. I think on the continent, I haven't been, my last count, I haven't been to 14 African countries. So I've been to 29, I think. Is it? Or 39. I've been to 39. That's scary. That's scary.
Good scary, not horror scary, good scary. Look, there's so many things you said that already I'm curious about, but let's get the deal with the elephant in the room here. I don't know whether to say critical green transition with respect to minerals, a simple conversation can turn into a deadlock just because we must first agree about definitions. But you and I have experience with this. We have experience with this, and it's everywhere around the world. So tell me, talk to me about this. What is it? Is it green? Is it transition? Is it critical? What is this? Because I'm confused. I don't know what to call it anymore. And this is the Just Energy Transition podcast. So clarify for our listeners what it is, really.
So no one has an authority on this. We have to, I think the first port of call is that no one has an authority on this. And after my explanation, hopefully you'll understand. On the periodic table, there is that D block. Right? That D block is known as the transition elements.
Okay, just so you're moving very quickly. So when we speak of periodic table, we're talking about the scientific table.
The scientific periodic table.
That labels elements.
Elements.
The D block is what you mean by D block?
Is mostly the middle, the ones that are in between.
Okay.
If you look at it, it's like a U, right? Mm. The plateaued part, the middle part, is called the D block. If I remember very well from my chemistry in A level. The bulk of some of these elements that are called critical fall in or behave as if they are within that part of the
periodic table.
And so they are called transition elements. And that's where then, from a chemistry's point of view, or a geochemist's point of view, or a geophysicist's point of view, there has been the very technical people who tell you why they are called transition metals, because they fall in that. I'm not a chemist, but I remember that, right? When I had a conversation with the geochemists that I had met in a certain forum, then they were like, why do people have arguments over calling a bird a plane? Right. Just because it flies, it doesn't make it a bird. And just because it flies, a bird is not a plane. But we'll let you, the ignorance who are just seeing anything in the plane. If you want to call it a plane, you call it a plane. If you want to call it a bird, you call it a bird. But us who know, we'll just let you, because all you are seeing is something that is flying. So that was how the description came from the geochemist's end of view. So remember, there are people who love to seem like they know everything. Now, when you have that little knowledge and you engage with your geochemists or chemists and they give you that term, you want to seem knowledgeable. And so you say, no, these are now transition minerals, or these are now transition elements, or whatever. That's one description of why they're called transition. The other one is, of course, from the socioeconomic scenario of ensuring that we are saying we are moving from, or we're transitioning from, fossil fuels, right, to clean energy, which is not so clean, but let's stick to that. Transitioning from fossil fuels into clean energy. And because of that, the metals that are required to produce the, for the lack of a better term, the machinery, the equipment that we're going to be using, the batteries, for instance, for storage, the turbines and all that, we then call them transition metals or transition minerals, because they are going to help us transition from oil and gas into clean energy. But remember, you need to mine them. Are you going to be using equipment that ensures that it's also clean? That's one thing. And then the processing of these minerals requires chemicals. Are those chemicals going to be washing into the ground? Are they going to be seeping into the ground? You see where the cleanliness then starts becoming questionable. But of course, the cleanliness here is in reference to the atmosphere vis-a-vis minimizing carbon dioxide emissions, which are greenhouse gases, right? That's the transition element that is socioeconomic and refers to the move from oil and gas and transitioning into clean energy. And then there is the strategic minerals. That's the other term they're used for. They're strategic because industry requires them. And industrialized nations, whether they like it or not, will always need a certain amount of these minerals to maintain their industries.
For example, for what? For what will they need it for?
Let's look at the, I spoke of a bird and a plane, right?
When we are flying,
there are certain materials amongst the so-called rare earth elements that work within turbines and the turbine fans, and they have a certain resilience when it comes to, what you call it, when they are turning, when a turbine is turning, right? It has to move. I mean, when they are, for instance, a Rolls-Royce plane engine, for it to maintain its physical integrity. Right. It has to be a certain metal. There's certain tensile strength within the metals and all that jazz. But it needs to be an alloy of a certain metal. And without that metal, you won't be able to. Jet engines, just generally. Let's just stick to jet engines, aeronautics. For me to fly to Morocco, instead of driving to Morocco, I need a plane, and that plane needs certain minerals, or should we say certain metals. All right. So,
I've got you. Okay.
But think of which African country you know that actually has a plane manufacturing plant. The answer is none. Or a jet manufacturing, what you call it, plant. The answer is none. But the industries that actually work towards this are not here. And they can't do with some of those metals or some of those minerals before they are metals. They are minerals when they're in the ground, these metals after processing. So for them to be processed into metals, right, and for those metals to then get into that industry, they have to exist somewhere. And Africa has them. But for us, we can't call them critical. They are critical to that industry, but they're not critical to our industry because we don't have an industry that actually uses these metals. So to us, we can't call them critical. I'm just speaking to that particular set of elements, the rare earth elements, for instance. They are the bulk of them in there. The ones that make permanent magnets, right, for turbines and all that. We do not have the industries that create permanent magnets. Permanent magnets are needed in every turbine. Turbines are needed to create electricity, right? Clean electricity if you are going to be running it from wind, if you're going to be running it from hydro.
Okay.
Right? Those industries are critical to the rest of the world as it stands right now, right? Because all of us are supposedly supposed to go into clean energy. But that criticality, once again, comes back as a question. If we sit on these minerals today, what will Africa's outright loss be? I am not advocating for that. I'm just saying the lack of industries on the continent is such that if we do not process some of these so-called metals at the rate that they are needed to transition, right, our lives won't change. But there are countries that will go on their knees in a month or two, right? Or a year, whichever. So to them, it definitely is critical. But the ability to transmit that criticality to our own industries or to our own existence starts being debatable.
Okay.
Hence, for us, it's not necessarily critical. But we understand why the world needs to go green. We understand why industries are supposed to move to clean production of certain products, right? We understand the existential crisis that greenhouse gases and carbon dioxide presents to the world, and the world has to go green, has to go cleaner, has to minimize emissions. We understand that. And we understand that minerals are an essential or at least a huge part of ensuring that those green industries overtake fossil fuels. And so for us, we then say they are green minerals for us. All right. As Africa, they are green to us. That's how we term them as green minerals. So as you can tell, everything is an issue of a narrative. And the sustained change of green. Of course, there are people who argue against green minerals because the term in itself is aligned to the former definition of what used to be green industry, which is not so green at the end of the day because it still requires fossil fuels to get certain parts of it going. So the term was at one point seen as greenwashing of industries, right? So that's why people...
Is that where the term greenwashing comes from?
Yes.
Okay, interesting. Well,
partly, mostly.
Yep. Okay.
We can get to that. We have stalwarts who want to, as you saw in Morocco, we have stalwarts who want to focus on why a particular terminology has to work or has to be stuck to. It's fine. It's understandable, right? We come from a practical, pragmatic perspective of what we need to do is to do A, B, C, D, and we're going to go about it this way. And we are also working against the issues of narratives. If we were to say an African critical mineral strategy, we are going to get to a point in time, and I love the fact that we have a generation of Africans that now questions the status quo on nearly anything and everything. Find there are the underlying issues as to why they end up calling themselves woke.
Yeah.
I foresee in my own futures thinking, futures way of thinking, 10, 15 years from now, there are certain narratives that are never going to be working for Africa. And Africans are going to be asking, why did we follow this? I would rather have 10, 15 years from now, while sitting in my retirement home, a person come to me and say, why did you call it a green mineral strategy? Or why were you okay with it being called a green mineral strategy? And I'll be like, well, this was the narrative we're going with. Tell me where I'm wrong. But I can assure you, 90% of the time, it's very likely that we are going to be saying, if we consider everything we are doing critical based on an agenda that is not ours, there are going to be Africans 10, 20 years down the line. Our kids are going to ask us, why were you moving with an agenda that was not pro-African and was not in our interests? And so that is where my Pan-Africanism or Pan-Africanist stance gets to be a bit tensile with other individuals. But remember, it's all an issue of how I feel. I'm not an authority on this matter, but this is how I see things. And it works well with the way that I'm currently working. I don't control what happens here, but I understand the basis of why certain things are being called certain things. For instance, the African Green Mineral Strategy. This is the thought process that we have. But we are not even going into the philosophical definitions of what is green and what isn't. It's an issue of this is our definition that is working towards Africa, understanding that it is green industries that it has to move towards and move more away from fossil fuels. Even though, for instance, there's another untouched discussion of how quickly are we going to do that? How quickly are we going to move from fossil fuels as a continent? We have to be very pragmatic. We know what happened when the Ukraine situation happened. Certain jurisdictions, certain African countries were told, let us work towards ensuring that you transition from fossil fuels, right? Get away from coal, right? Get away from gas. It's not working. Yes, we understand you have minimum emissions to the rest of the world, but you know, let's make sure we prepare you and use you guys as the perfect example of transitioning. A special operation happens in Ukraine. It stops the movement of a certain fossil fuel to a certain jurisdiction at a time when it is critical to have heating.
I hear you.
Lo and behold, the countries that are being told to stop producing, what they're being asked to stop producing, they're now being asked to export, right, to a jurisdiction that requires it because it is definitely life-threatening. I thought climate change was life-threatening to everybody. So if it really was life-threatening, there is no way you can then come in and say, but for now, let us focus on the fact that we need to deal with the current unfortunate situation, and then we'll go back to dealing with climate change issues. I mean, we have to say it lightly, but that is the reality. And whenever this is brought up in any international fora discussion, there's no response to it, right? So the existentialist question of what Africa considers critical for its own development is out the window at the end of the day if you realize we don't define what is critical for ourselves. And so that's one of the reasons why I'm saying it's neither here nor there calling it green, strategic, whatever. But if you start thinking deeply as to why we shouldn't just be following narratives, right? There are people who are very good at saying, yes, Africa, at the end of the day, is still a follower. So why do you want to confuse those that are still working towards changing things? It's fine. You can say that. But it is also intellectually correct to say we can define our own terminologies. I think. Anyway, I'm not much of an academic. You are.
Well, I think you're being humble there, even when you said I'm not much of an expert, because I know your CV. And the thing is, you know, people who come on this podcast are people who've earned respect in their field. And now what I want to understand is this, is that if somebody who really wants to champion this new age, this new net zero age of sustainable development gets to a conference and they use one of these terms, which one will be most accepted? Because I've seen the pushback against green, and you use your fingers to quote. So maybe let's do it this way chronologically. Scientifically, they were called transition minerals because of their periodic table. So this was a scientific. They still can be, okay? Because you transition from the top to the bottom, bottom to the top of the periodic table.
Left to right.
So, oh, yeah, left, right. Okay, left, right. Oh, yeah, the D block, left, right. Okay, so that's a mere fact. That's not, that has nothing to do with sociology. They call transition because of this. And then what came next, critical or green, in terms of the chronology here, the evolution of the term?
Well, the term critical minerals was existed for years on end. I think post-World War II, I think.
Mm-hmm.
When the U.S. declared certain minerals, actually, the U.S. never used the term critical. They called them strategic, I think. Certain mm-hmm. minerals were strategic to the defense industries, right? Mm-hmm. And they have a list. And this list, right? Ah, so it comes back to why we call them green. This list, right, of strategic minerals depends on what is considered strategic for the socioeconomic planning of the country. Right, of the U.S. at the time. They knew they needed to make weapons of a certain grade using certain metals for a certain number of years. So for those years, they needed to secure the supply of particular minerals. And so those minerals for that time frame were strategic. Now, this list changes periodically. Sometimes, so there are elements that are added on because you realize during the processing of a mineral that maybe you need another mineral to be part of this to make the whole processing processing efficient. You want the processing to be efficient, so you add on a particular mineral, you take out another one, etc. So in terms of strategic minerals, it then becomes those that are added on and those that are taken out. All right. Okay. So the strategic nature of it then depends on how you are working and what you need the minerals for. Mm-hmm. So this only became critical when, and this is not necessarily in the U.S., when certain industries in certain jurisdictions beyond the U.S., but of course allies to the U.S. and what, which lo and behold are also global north or the general west, all the industries that they required needed certain elements to definitely maintain production of certain elements. And so they became critical for that industry, right? For those industries to continue moving. In the U.S., it was for the defense industry. So they may have been critical for the defense industry, but they were not critical to the whole economy. But there are certain economies in certain jurisdictions where the missing of a particular mineral can actually shut down a whole industry. But in the U.S., they actually have mineralization that's nearly equal to some of the best mineralized regions in the world. They don't necessarily mine, but you see, then that's why the term critical to them is not really critical, but we understand our allies is critical, but it's not really critical, but it's definitely strategic in terms of their defense industry.
Exactly. And I'll interject there to say that we know that their budget largely, their budget goes into defense. So it's certainly strategic. It's certainly strategic to them. Okay, so this I understand now. Global North started calling it strategic, and also this links to critical. So how did the African position settle on green? Because we know now the just transition movement kind of piggybacked on the scientific roots of it. To say it's transition already, let's just call it transition. But how did Africa come to settle on green as the term?
Because we have a dearth in industrialization on the continent. We can argue, and though it would be an interesting argument, there are not more than 10, I don't want to use the term critical, but let's use it. There are not more than 10 critically industrialized countries on the continent, right? That could exist for themselves or the region in which they are in, if they focused entirely on industrializing or on adding value, on creating manufacturing industries. We don't go beyond 10. We are a continent of 55 countries. And by saying 10, I'm being very generous. Right? When you ask an economist who wants to be downright crude and unemotional in their response, and you say, how many industrialized countries are there on the continent? He'll tell you two. One in the north, one in the south. We won't mention. Okay. But I can ask you, if I say guess, 99% of the time when you say someone in the south, you know exactly which country I'm talking about. In the north, it depends how well you know the north. For a person who really knows the north, they'll know which country. For those who don't, they may guess, but their guesses won't go beyond three before they get the answer correct.
Okay.
But I'm speaking from a position of all African countries as a Pan-Africanist are realizing there is need to actually start producing for themselves. But the balkanized nature of their economies means they now have to start producing for themselves and the region. So there are countries that are working towards that dynamic, which is why the AfCFTA is coming in or has come in or has since come in at the best time in Africa's trajectory.
I'm going to don't mind me. The terms, some terms that you use, our listeners may not be familiar with, even though you and I may be familiar with them. What is the
AfCFTA? The AfCFTA is the African Continental Free Trade Agreement. It's not yet an area because as much as we have 48 countries that have signed on to it, I think it's not all of them that have ratified vis-a-vis have accepted that this is our trading bloc as a continent agreement. Some countries still have negotiations ongoing in certain sectors on what can move from one country to another without tariffs, or if there are some countries that are moving semi-processed goods into another, what percentage of that semi-processed good considers it or renders it eligible to tariff-free access throughout the continent. These are all discussions and negotiations that are ongoing. I think some of them are actually done. The bulk of them are done. So here, within the issue of minerals and metals, if we are to start processing some of these minerals into metals, we have to be able to use them, right? That requires a certain level of industrialization. But how many countries are industrialized to the point of needing the amount that can be processed from the minerals we have, right? I'll stick to what we consider one of the minerals on the continent as part of the green mineral strategy. I'll stick to phosphates. In the grand scheme of things, when it comes to the just transition, phosphates are part of the chemistry that is used in battery storage, right? LFP, that's lithium iron phosphate, being the main components of certain storage batteries. The chemistries that are available there require lithium iron and phosphate to be part of this scenario, right? Of that battery or that storage scenario. But if we are able, right, to add value or process some of these minerals into that chemistry and be within the value chain that provides lithium, iron, and phosphates towards that chemistry, it means we have managed to also open up industries that can break down some of these minerals for other industries. For iron, we all know the amount of construction that the continent needs if we are to match the housing needs that the continent has, robust housing needs that the continent may need. As it stands, I have not seen anyone in cities staying in mud houses, which in itself historically is not necessarily a bad thing, but cities require concrete and steel for buildings, right? If you realize, I'm not sure how many African countries actually import their steel and iron roads from another African country. I'm not sure. I actually haven't done that research, but I don't think there are many, if at all, there are any.
So they're able to source these domestically?
They source them domestically, but where's the source? Right. Where's the source? But that's because there's no iron and steel industry on the continent meant for the continent. It's always meant for export. But if we decide
And as a continent or as a regional bloc, as a continent is still a bit far-fetched, but as regional blocs, if we decide to say we have one country where iron deposits are enough to be processed for the next 20, 30 years with an offtake of housing or construction linked to that processing of that iron into steel roads, into iron roads that are meant for construction, we then start creating a market internally that uses the iron that is on the continent for continental benefits. Whilst we have special, or should we say, aligned industries in processing iron, right, that can then focus in a certain type of iron, a certain type of specialized iron that focuses on LFP batteries, the lithium iron and phosphate batteries, create the precursors to making those batteries, but then just focusing on that type of iron from the generalized iron production sector meant for the continent.
But what you're describing there, and let me throw this cog in the wheel, is the neoclassical idea by Ricardo of comparative advantage when it comes to trade.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, just to plant something, we still need to get to how we calling it green. We were talking about industrialization. We'll get there. But some people would argue and say, well, Mkululi, this idea is a neoclassical, it's a Western idea of comparative advantage. It's been around in neoclassical economics for a very long time. How can you claim that such a strategy would be purely African? I don't know if you want to go down that now, but I think let's finish the green. But I want to plant that flag and we can discuss narratives. But you were still telling us about industry and how it got to the green. Yes, continue there.
So in all this production that we're talking about, right? Mm. If we are to do it in a manner that minimizes emissions, green, if we go green and we minimize emissions and it is environmentally friendly, for instance, there's such a term as green steel. Very few people know that there's a term as green steel. Of course, it minimizes the amount of coking coal that gets into the production of steel from iron. And there are other processes apparently that actually make it green. But if we do it in a manner that aligns to the global decarbonization agenda, whilst we are still industrializing for ourselves, right? In terms of using steel and iron as that example, it means we've gone green, right? We naturally create green iron or green steel, not green industry, right? That's just one way of industrializing in a green manner. We also remember phosphates, right? Bulk part of our fertilizer scenario.
In focus agriculture.
Exactly. So you focus on the LFP, for instance, at the moment, we're thinking of decarbonizing using battery storage. Battery storage then gets into vehicles, etc. We don't have emissions. But at the same time, if you can branch off from that and focus on, right, the way that NPK fertilizers come up, right, nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, and these are all things that we could get during our industrialization and create phosphates, or should we say phosphate-based fertilizers for our agriculture. I'll give you another classic case to digress. There are countries that still depend on Ukraine for fertilizer. It's a country at war. And yet we still import fertilizers from Ukraine. Something that we could do if we were to... No, something that could be stopped. I'm not saying I have any issues with importing fertilizers from Ukraine. I'm just giving you the nuanced thought process of if we are to be involved in the industrialization of Africa, but from a green perspective that does not defeat the purpose of decarbonizing the world, right? Then we use these minerals for our own green industrialization, but at the same time, it touches on everything else
that ensures that we remain green. In this case, I'm talking about agriculture. Right, phosphates, okay. Agriculture. Construction, I've mentioned, I've touched. So our ability to still stick to the term green without being controversial, but just needing people to hear us out, at the same time as making sure we do not necessarily follow the narrative that is being given elsewhere. Narratives matter. People undermine the value of narratives. If a person is willing to listen to me as to why we are calling green minerals green, it means at some point during my description of why we're calling them green, they understand the perspective and viewpoints of where we're coming from. We're not just plucking words out of the blue. We're doing it because we are thinking of way beyond minerals. We're thinking of what else is tied into the whole developmental narrative of the minerals part. Right. So this is why green minerals is the term we're using. A lot of people think it's just picking it from the blue and sticking it to issues of green industry. But there's a whole narrative that can be aligned to not even industry and still stick to being green. Right. We are maintaining the environmental friendly nature of how we are doing things, whilst we are sticking to the ability of the world to decarbonize, right? Which to them, that's how green is. But the fact that a person can start understanding why we're calling them green minerals, I personally believe, this is my personal perspective. This is not the institution's thought process, but that's how I narrate it, because no one can ever force me to use the term critical, especially if they are working from, I love the way you brought in the term neoclassical definition.
Yeah. Right?
The neoclassical definition of critical. Fair and fine, you can call it critical, but let me use the term green because I understand where I'm coming from and where I want to go to.
I'm sold. I hear you. I completely hear you. And I think if I had this kind of context when we met, I would have understood better.
It was difficult at that point, my brother. We were fighting too many battles.
Indeed. And so, you know what, like, you've had a great career, and what I would like to know in terms of your journey, because you described the mining, it was 2009, right? The mining. Yeah. So how did it, why would we have, okay, so we understand that a lot of, like you said, minerals and mineral deposits are mined here. So why did it go from a mining strategy to a minerals strategy? Was there a change of a paradigm there? Because it started from a mining perspective, but then it became a mineral perspective. What do you think triggered that as we speak about narratives?
So the Africa Mining Vision had to align itself to the way people understand Africa. So the Africa Mining Vision is not entirely about mining. It's an actual developmental framework. And just to be clear, the African Green Mineral Strategy is a mere distillation of the Africa Mining Vision, but it just focuses on the minerals that are called the green minerals that we refer to as green minerals. From a narrative perspective, the Africa Mining Vision is a framework and a developmental framework at that, that works towards equitable resource-based industrialization. And the African Green Mineral Strategy is focusing on how the green minerals can achieve equitable resource-based industrialization, right? And the Africa Green Mineral Strategy has only just been adopted by heads of state after it went through the processes of the African Union organs to becoming a continental document. It has recently just been adopted.
Congrats.
Thank you. It was Yes, it was a battle, but a good battle at that, because it had to have conversations like this. Even within jurisdictions where people support us, they still want it to be called a critical mineral strategy. They're like, yes, we understand everything you're talking about. We understand why you're calling it green, but let's just call it critical and get to move on, right? But fair and fine, like I said, I'm hoping I got you sold as to why we're calling it the green mineral strategy. But that green mineral strategy is a distillation of the Africa Mining Vision, which at the time that it came up, and I'm not sure how many people are listening who have had the narrative of this mining vision scenario going on. But in 2009, when the Africa Mining Vision was first shouted to the world, there were jurisdictions that went outright against it to say it is a, what do they call it? Which I find very interesting because in the context of what is happening nowadays, they were calling it a resource nationalism agenda. That's what it was called. It was demonized by certain jurisdictions. Some jurisdictions were outrightly fighting against it to the extent of approaching African member states to say, let's leave this conversation of this Africa mining vision. Let's continue on the path that we have been on, because if you want to renegotiate deals, if you want to renegotiate whatever, we can do that. But this narrative, can we please leave it out there, because it's not good for business. It's not good for investment, right? And all it was asking for was for Africa to start being part of its own developmental framework, using the same mineral that are required in other jurisdictions, but using it for Africa's development. And I had to bring the resource nationalism term up front, because what was happening in 2009 and being used as a demonizing statement is becoming normal in certain jurisdictions as well, that at the time were calling it resource nationalism. There are certain jurisdictions that are outrightly declaring that certain resources should only be used within their jurisdiction, and no foreigner can be involved in there. And I'm like, we were saints in 2009. Some of the things that are happening now when it comes to resource nationalism, 2009, the Africa Mining Vision was a very progressive one, because it never said no one should come into the continent to get the minerals. It was in Africa also start being part of, right, its own development using the minerals that are within its jurisdiction, which is what it still stands to say today. You stop pervasive poverty existing next to mineral wealth by ensuring that the mineral wealth translates to citizenry wealth, not by issue of rents or royalties of selling the minerals, but the value chain being harnessed across from exploration to extraction to processing to manufacturing to end product development. Each one of these parts, right, has aligned industries to it, has aligned educational, well, if we consider education as a sector, it has aligned educational offshoots to it, right? It has aligned finance offshoots to it. We need banks that can be creative enough to actually finance this whole product, all these products or these product processes, right? And aligning them to the collateralization of the same minerals, because they are global markets for what comes at the end point, right? You stick to gold, you explore for gold, you mine gold, you process gold. No one has ever eaten gold. But if you're a country that processes gold and aligns its development to the value of that gold in a manner that retains your own currency to be at a certain flotation, as it were, in comparison to the rest of the world. You don't necessarily say your currency is gold-backed. But let us ask ourselves, who has the most gold in their vaults? And let's look at what their currency is like. I'm not saying there's a correlation. I'm just saying, let's do a simple exercise. Who has the most gold in their vaults? What does their currency look like? Right? So this issue of wealth being next to where the source of the wealth is coming from is all that we're talking about. We need an equity structure to ensure that minerals being mined prove to the people that are around, surrounding, and within the jurisdictions that they are being mined that this is something that is working for us, right? And so 2009, when that was all we were saying, the demonization that was coming with it. And these are the same people who, to this day, I know of certain people who, at the time I was a young man in 2009, I know them because it used to hurt me, but I was too young to say anything. I was not seen as anything. But I know some of these people who, to this day, are now quoting how the AMV right? The Africa Mining Vision, how the AMV is a transformative document that requires greater engagement for ensuring that Africa benefits from its own minerals. I'm like, bruv, why were you not educated in 2009? Because if you were, at what point did you diseducate yourself and come back to understanding this? Because I remember distinctly you were not for the AMV. So anyway, the African Green Mineral Strategy is a distillation of the AMV. And so that strategy now speaks of an action plan towards how we're actually going to do this. Because the other challenge that we have, African strategies and documents and frameworks are always blamed as to very good on paper, have no implementation plan. Right? Have an implementation plan, do not have implementation resources. Or have the implementation resources, but it's not being channeled in the correct manner. Fortunately for the
There's always something wrong with the system. Yeah.
But fortunately for the Green Mineral Strategy, and I believe this is the, well, from my perspective, it is a strategy that a person can read and say, yes, it makes sense. And when they ask, how is it done? Right? They can't ask that in earnest. You get? It is done in such a manner, when it comes out, you realize, when it comes out, anyone who reads it and understands the strategic entry points into it, all its elements, all its strategic implementation elements exist. Right? So when a person asks, and I say a person here, I'm speaking to the African citizens themselves, when they ask, but how is it done? After reading that, we will have a challenge. If African citizens are asking, how is it done after reading it, then we have a challenge. Because it means after being taught how to fish, we still want to ask, so if you give me that rod, where do I fish? You get.
Yeah, I hear you.
This is how I see this document, just our perspective. And I have fortunately, and as I told you in Morocco, I fortunately have a cohort of African industrialists who I will never, in this day and age, shout out in public as to who they are, right? Because I've also understood that there are certain things that should work in silence until they are proven correct, right? And for in this case, it's not even proving it correctly. It's until they are done. There are certain people. Yes, I will celebrate others. Others, I can hint it. But the fact that I look at the whole value chain of the African Green Mineral Strategy, I know all players on the continent who have a Pan-African mindset, who understand the challenges we are fighting. Because remember, when we look at Africa, we all sometimes just look at Africa. We are the world's global chessboard. Right. The geopolitics of this world is referred to as China versus the US and whatnot. But when you get into minerals development and you get into understanding manufacturing and processes aligned to manufacturing, you realize that what we are seeing, right, and it's coming out as a geopolitical struggle. There are many other players that have nothing to do with the geopolitics of the world that still want to ensure we remain a chessboard. Right? It is not their fault. When you speak to issues of capital, it is the nature of capitalism. If you speak to
self-interest, yes.
Yes, exactly. So in the interest of self-interest, and by self here I'm speaking to African interests, certain Africans have to remain quiet as they do things big. Right? We have to have a bubbling under set of Africans who are doing these things quietly. And when they are stopped quietly, and we strategize quietly. Not everyone is going to make it, but for those that do, we're going to ensure that we rope in everyone else who is part of this, because everything is connected. from the financing of exploration to the offtake of products. I remember when I was growing up, there was this statement, do you know where buttons are made? Think of the number of buttons that are in the world. Have you ever counted the number of buttons that are on your shirt?
No, I haven't. Eh? And they even come extra when you buy a suit.
Right.
They never thought
of where they are made.
Yeah, that's true.
Right?
That's true.
But there's someone out there who wants to make sure that clothes remain using buttons. Right? That design mindset exists because they are part of that value chain that makes buttons. We import buttons in their billions, in their whatever. And because it's something that is a dollar for a thousand, right? You don't think about being part of that value chain. And that is where the whole argument is to, yes, but you know, it's a globalized thing. So why should Africa be focusing on making buttons? That's just an example. But to stick to that buttons example, why should we be focusing on making buttons? Because the offshoots of making the button is where the value is. Being able to be part of the design mindset of making buttons means you're thinking in a certain way. If you are able to make buttons, it means you have specialized your ability, right, in making micro entities. The machinery that makes that micro entity, right, is made where that's part of the engineering value chain that is there. Buttons don't just wake up in the morning and are there. There has to be a machine that makes them. Who makes those machines, right? Who thinks of how to upgrade the efficiency of that machine? That job is not in Africa because you are very comfortable in importing 10,000 buttons for a dollar.
But this speaks to this idea of strategic humility. So if I have to take, for an example, the example of the Republic of China, who decided, you know what, let's be for several decades the dumping ground of cheap labor, cheap production of the world, and that will help us build our manufacturing capability. So that's an idea of strategic, for example, humility. You know, you're talking about buttons, you know, simple things like buttons, toothpicks. Young people on the continent don't want to walk around with a label that I'm a button maker. But strategic humility at some point is necessary. How do we go about? In fact, I like your narrative. Aside from your lovely work jet setting around the continent, you dabble in some farming, I believe. And that example gives us an idea of what you're speaking about, the offshoots. Can you just break down how something as humble as cattle farming in one's home, rural or otherwise, with how the opportunities are actually embedded there that we don't usually see?
Well, I think of the industrialization. I'm a cattle farmer. Growing up, of course, my father knew I'm still a child. But growing up, I thought because we sold, and for us, we didn't sell our beef to other butcheries. We had the whole value chain. Right. We made our own feed, right, from our farm. We grew our own cattle feed, made our own feed, sold the beef to our own butcheries, where we would lose value by taking it to an abattoir that is not controlled by us. But after slaughtering, would come back and then sell that beef to our own butchery. And then within the butchery, we'd make our own sausages, we'd make our own biltong, and all that. But when you slaughter the cattle, we would make sure we retain the hides, right, for the cattle that have been slaughtered. So we usually it was 10 to 15 cattle at a time that we would go for slaughter. So we would retain our 10 to 15 cattle hides, right? And after a good 4 or 5 slaughters, we have close to 100 and sometimes just over 100 hides. And then we would take those hides to a nearby tannery, right? That would buy those hides from us. But for me as a child, I would always be like, but what do they do with these heights? Right?
Be curious.
And my father would be like, but you're wearing shoes. And I'd be like, yes. And then he's like, you're wearing the kettle height. I'd be like, no, I want to see it. So I would see the whole process, right? These drums of tanning, how the hides would be in there for a good 48 to 72 hours, depending on how much of the hides have been put in there and how much they want to get out. When they are tanned, the chemicals that are put into there, the lime that is put into the whole processing of the, what do you call it, leather, before it was tanned leather. It would be called, at the end of a particular process, the tanner would have what they call, what do they call it? Tanned blue, right? And that tanned blue is the one that's marketable to the rest of the world, especially if you've done it in such a manner that you've gotten the hides from people who don't mess up their cattle, they don't hit their cattle. You know, when you're in Africa, when a cow is misbehaving, you hit it, whatever. So it leaves a mark, it scars. But for those cattle that are not scarred, those hides are perfected. And they then become, when they're tanned blue, they fetch premium prices in the leather market. Right. And the chemicals that are used, incidentally, are also a value chain that it comes into cattle feed. Right. When it comes to lime, agricultural lime, and then tanning lime, all come from lime. So it depends on what quality of lime you have. Incidentally, lime is also in construction, right? In cement, right? These are all specialized industries that are aligned to the same components. And within that industry, right? Or aligned to that particular industry. I got to know all this just because I wanted to see where my school shoe was made, right?
And how then, it connected to what you guys were doing at home.
Exactly. Now, that's just cattle farming as us. But then if you then bring on board 20 ranchers, right, who are also offloading 10 to 15 cattle per month to a particular abattoir, then you have a good 600 or so hides at a time that are being processed. You have a full-on tannery. But that tannery definitely wants to make sure the ranchers keep bringing those cattle, right? And so they will have financiers within the tannery who understand that by financing farmers and maintaining the herd of farmers, it maintains the tannery business itself.
Okay. Right?
So they start having an interest in ensuring that farmers grow their cattle, feed their cattle in a certain manner to make sure that the hide is supple and they don't mistreat the cattle and all that jazz, even though the feed is being made. I mean, even though the cattle are being made for, what do you call it, for the butchery or whatnot. I've just described in a simple manner the accounting profession, the financing profession, right? The agricultural lime profession. And the fashion industry. Because cow leather jackets, and sheep leather jackets have a distinct difference. But if you do your cow leather jackets coming from a skin that is supple and they are nearly as soft as sheep leather jackets, the pricing of a cow leather jacket, right, will be a good 4 or 5 times the price of a sheep leather jacket. Because it's solid. I mean, I have quite a number of leather jackets. That's the reason why I have a ridiculous amount of leather jackets.
Yeah, so you're doing some marketing here.
So that is that. That's just an example of, if you think of how, oh, by the way, for you to actually get that lime, you have to mine it. Lime doesn't just exist. You mine that lime. But then you mine that lime, depending on whether you're mining it for the construction business vis-a-vis cement, or you know that as much as you're mining it for cement, you're also thinking of how the low-quality lime is going to be part of the deliming exercise within agriculture, is also going to be part of feed, of cattle feed, and it's also going to be part of, lime-based fertilizers, right? And then those fertilizers grow your fodder, your fodder that's going to be feeding your cattle. And the cycle of secularity comes into being. I always find it interesting that people are now talking about secularity because it seems to be an existential crisis solution. But I'm like, any country that is agro-based should be funded for secularity by the global financial architecture. It's nothing innovative, but it's just because most countries that are actually based on secularity models are not part of the global financial architecture because we were always the bottom of the barrel. We are nothing more than raw material producers. And so when it comes to the global financial architecture, we should also be at the bottom of the barrel in terms of being funded for what we are doing. You get? I'm sorry.
No. I think two problems arise from what you're saying. The first problem, then, it seems, so you very wonderfully showed us how one thing, cattle farming done right, has got so many offshoots. Two problems that I see there for the continent, I want to plant these flags and then go deeper into the green mineral strategy, is first and foremost, our young people don't think any of that is sexy or cool. Okay, so we have people who want to do tannery. I've never heard ever. I work with many young people, teach many. I've never heard anybody ever say, I want to do tannery or start a tannery business ever. Now, so that's the first problem. So we, as the young generation, don't think any of this that you said is sexy. But even if we did, the second part is that it would need a community that works with one another. In your case, your family's cattle farm would have to trust the abattoir. The abattoir would have to trust you back. And all these things would need to happen. So there needs to be trust. I think these two things are lacking, that self-respect and that artisanal self-respect and the trust. So how does the green minerals strategy seek to build that within the continent? How does it address these social things that get in the way of us implementing our plans and our documents?
I would say for anyone who reads it with an objective mindset, you realize the push is towards regionalist thinking. Right.
What do you mean by that?
From a country perspective, never believe, I'm sorry to come back to what it seems like. It will seem like I'm going towards comparative advantage descriptions, but I will describe it this way. Never believe you should do everything. That's the first point, right? And that you can do everything, right? So in the description that I had of the farming, of our cattle farming business, the biggest challenge that our family had was maintaining each part of the value addition process. We could have easily built our own abattoir, but as a family business, we were so tied down to each part of the value chain. We were like, listen, there's no point in us doing this because we are already bogged down by the inefficiencies of running everything ourselves. Right? If we had just stuck to ensuring that the herd produces the choice grade beef that is being harnessed by a supple cowhide, right? That's all we focused on. Feed the cattle, feed them well, maintain them, vaccinate them on time, and which we did, but just focus on that, specialize on that. What it would mean is if we had a link to someone who just focused on getting our beef, right, and then marketing our beef according to its grade, which we always targeted the choice grade, right, sort of like the top of the, right, that person would then make sure they get more value for money. And they would constantly push us to retain the ability to produce the best. Because there are times when you'd say of the 15 cattle that we have sent to the abattoir, 12 of them make the choice grade. The others are just super. Or worst case scenario, they are economy. Right? These are the grades. So there's economy. There's manufacturing. There's economy. There's super. And then there's choice. Right? These are the gradings of the beef. So we would then be like, let's just stick to ensuring that we just send choice grade beef. But we couldn't do that because our aim was to make sure within a particular period, we're sending 15 cattle there. But at the same time, we're focusing on creating the feed for them to make sure that this happens, right? Mm-hmm. If someone else was making that feed, and then we are just focusing on the herd. Now, all this to say, the specialization of a country, which in simple terms is comparative advantage, the specialization of a country, but knowing how they fit into the bigger block of progress.
Mm.
If we take advantage of the fact that we have countries that can produce a certain mineral, right, and they process and add value to it within the country, but knowing full well that the next stage of value addition is in the next country, what it means is we will then upgrade the transport logistics to ensure that there is minimum inefficiencies between what you have processed and getting it to the next value addition. I will give that example based on how Zimbabwe, I'll come back to Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe had one of the most efficient railway networks on the continent in the 60s and the 70s. And as much as it was a marvel to celebrate for human transportation or passenger transportation, what it actually was meant for was feedstocks moving around the country, right? Coal from Mwange coming to Kwekwe, right? Gold was certain parts of the country, but of course that wasn't necessarily meant for being transported by train. But coal from Mwange to get to Kwekwe and a certain type of iron to come from Bukwa, and then transporting, what else were we transporting? The rail transport network in the country was meant to move goods more than people. But to the uninitiated, they thought this was just for moving people. But this means that there was industries that are linked and aligned to how the rail network was built and maintained. Right? So you create your financial models as a region for transporting, whether it's minerals processed in one country, to the next value chain station, but make sure that it is financially viable for all of you as a collective. Because as one country, it means one country has to then focus on not only adding value to it, but also creating the transport network. Put your heads together as a region. We are going to create a railway network that moves from, which is what sometimes irks me when I hear that the Lobito Corridor is being invested in by people beyond the continent. Nothing against what they are bringing to the continent, but the fact that it had to have an external funding, right, to be revived and maintained. And yet, why do you think that is happening? To secure mineral access, right, to get out of the continent. Right.
So here's a question. Where then does the green mineral strategy, where is the first leverage point? So given these challenges and given this wonderful analogy that you've told us about the Zimbabwe rail line, your own personal experience growing up and even now as a cattle farmer, where is the first leverage point, the first leverage point that the green minerals strategy, where does it start? So if we get this right, we can move to the next phase. What is the first victory there that we're attempting to win?
Accepting as a collective that we have the minerals. Accepting as a collective that we need to know how much of these minerals we have. If we accept that not only do we have the minerals, we need to know what we have on the ground, right? Because mineral exploration is a hefty business. You need a serious amount of money to engage in knowing exactly what you have underground to a certain degree of certainty. If we all collectively start accepting that, yes, these minerals, these green minerals of ours, are needed by everyone else, including ourselves, if we decide to industrialize to get some of these things going. And as a collective, we all remember mineralization does not follow borders. So in finding out what we have as a collective, exploration being done in Zim should be aligned to the exploration being done in Zambia, should be aligned to the exploration being done in DRC, should be aligned to the exploration being done in Uganda, in South Sudan, in Mozambique, in South Africa itself, in Botswana. Once we know where all these minerals are and what we have, whilst in the process of looking at what we have, we are also intentionally seeking out what can be made, right, from what we have. Then we start working. That's the first port of call. And that's what it speaks to. Advancing mineral development is pillar one of the African Green Mineral Strategy. And that actually means knowing what we have on the ground. We advance it for ourselves, right? Whilst we are pushing for STEM education to happen, right? It is because we know that STEM education is going to get into geosciences, right? And those geosciences are going to be involved in ensuring we know exactly what is underground and anything that shoots off to that. Geosciences include hydrology. I always say, we have challenges. The amount of groundwater on the continent that is untapped because of the untapped underground rivers on the continent, right? It's such that we should not necessarily be dependent on rains either, right? But that comes to geosciences as well. You are doing your exploration, you understand there's an underground river here, or there's a water stream that is linking to fissures underground, whatever, that are that can bring up water. You focus on if upon exploration of not finding anything here except for water bodies underground, you then ensure that that becomes agricultural land and we start feeding ourselves. The fact that I go back to this Ukraine issue, African countries had to have a meeting on food security when war in Ukraine started. That is an indictment on ourselves. It's not like we are a barren desert continent. We have arable land. Mining exploration can be aligned to the geophysics of wanting to understand the hydrology of a place vis-a-vis where you can get water at what depth, right? I say this because one of the other businesses our family dabbled into was borehole drilling. And that was because my father was a geologist, right? So this is something that you'd say to me in passing, of course. But I digress. When we start finding out what we have, oh, and by the way, water is a mineral as well. Let's not forget that. No one ever thinks about that. Water is a mineral. So knowing what we have, right, is the first port of call for the African Green Mineral Strategy. And a person who understands the mining value chain will start questioning me and saying, oh, so where do you get the exploration funding, right? So we have what we call the African Minerals Energy and Resource Classification Framework that incorporates what we call the Pan-African Resources Reporting Code. Jointly, it's known as AMREC-PAC. And this is our way of collateralizing. I'm putting it in simple terms. All right.
Yeah.
Collateralizing what we have on the ground and aligning it to the growth of capital markets that are on the continent.
And speaking one language, right? So being able to, that's right.
The Pan-African,
so we can trade using the same language.
And you know the information you have is standardized.
Right?
It's standardized based on what you want to do with the mineral information that you have done in your exploration and all that jazz. And for the purposes of those that don't understand this, AMREC then has the ability to, it's based, the classification is based on a globally recognized and, dare I say, leading, right, classification principle called the United Nations Framework Classification. Right?
You have to start somewhere, huh?
Yeah, you have to start. Yeah, exactly. But AMREC is actually based on these leading principles of ensuring that you don't just explore, but you explore to demonstrate that at times it's not all minerals that are supposed to be mined. It's better to leave them underground than to mine them, right? And now that you know that it is better to leave them underground, it means you can still collateralize their existence down there, right? As a foregone, for the lack of a better term, a foregone profit, right? By leaving them underground. But if the whole world fail when, what did they call them? Toxic assets failed to be monetized in 2008, right? This was based on people literally selling air or toxic air to each other. But if we can actually collateralize and know what is underground and say we are leaving it there, but based on the fact that we've left it there, we can put a value on it, right? I'm not a finance guru, but I know for sure this is where you start having finance capitalists, if they have the interests of the capital or of the continent at heart, can actually collateralize what is underground by virtue of it never being touched. Right. But for the purposes of ensuring that the decarbonization agenda globally is still met, you can always value that, put it as a bond of some sort, call it a green bond, pun intended, call it a green bond, right? And start feeding African capital markets based on the knowledge of what you have underground. It sounds like it's crazy, but it's actually done, right? But because it's now about to be done by Africans, it then becomes crazy, right? I have Africans who have asked me, where is this exploration funding going to come from? Because, you know, exploration companies need to have some form of capitalization, and where on the continent do you get this capital? I reverse that question and I say, where are they getting it now? Yes, of course. They go to Toronto. They go to, they go to Australia. They go to, and I'm like, bruv, think about what you're saying. If there was a way for us to actually have functional capital markets on the continent, right? Then that means you're not going to Toronto, right? You're going to Nairobi.
Indeed.
You're going to Ghana. And if you're going to be complaining about illicit financial flows, this is where I'm going to say something very, for the lack of a better term, controversial.
That's what we want.
I would rather have financial flows move from Kenya to Ghana than from Kenya to beyond the shores of the continent. I would rather have illicit financial flows move from an African country to another African country to develop that African country. Because eventually we are still going to remain on the continent. We ourselves are going to be our own developers of our continent. No one is going to come here to develop us for us. If you find development now being brought to us for us, know that it is not for us.
There's a price to it.
There's no free lunch. And it is not just a saying. It is true. There is no free lunch. So that's the AMREC Park document I'm talking about. Is aligned to how we're going to be implementing this African Green Mineral Strategy. But like I said, where does it start? We have to know what we have.
Okay.
We have to know what we have.
Okay, so that's the starting point. That's the main lever. And I think we should get our listeners and stakeholders to focus on that, because you can't skip that step. And of course, we'd want to encourage people. Where can they find this document?
They should Google AMREC Park. I think it is now on the AU website.
And the strategy?
The strategy will be on the web. We have the abridged version because, like I said, it has just been adopted at the AU Summit. But it should be signed off. It was adopted, but it should be signed off within the next 2 weeks and at most a month. Then it will be publicly available. But that's secondary. And then the other point of departure of the Green Mineral Strategy, and this is where I think we sometimes get it wrong. Someone who's listening and hearing me say exploration is where we need to start, I am speaking to the value chain process and where the so-called financing seems to be a hurdle, which is financing of exploration.
Okay.
But every other part has to start as well. Right.
All right. Okay. Yeah. So it's not a domino effect you're looking for here.
It's a literal sprouting of everything at the same time. I think once was a movie called Everything Everywhere at the same time or something like that. Right. That's what is meant to happen. And that's why I was saying I have that cohort of what I call Afrocrats who are along the value chain. And as a continent, power is our biggest issue. That's the one thing we're always told by financiers from beyond the continent, that even if you want to add value, we want to help you. But you do not have reliable power, right? It is true. But if we all work towards collective insurance, collective assurance of power going to processing, for instance, metals, to process bauxite into alumina, it's just an issue of adding a lot of heat, right, to bauxite, right? But that heat has to be maintained and sustained, right? If we have functional power pools, then that means we can supply the required amount of power to the industry that is going into metal fabrication, into metal manufacturing, into metal processing, into manufacturing, right? Whilst we maintain a certain lid of power that is going to residential, to whatever.
I want to come in there and wean us off from this. You're going to have to be a returning guest. You just dropped too many jewels and I have so many questions. But you know, for this session, you need to be a returning guest. I'm very serious about this. But we still need to talk about AI. We still need to talk about all these things and the work you've done with regional integration. But maybe as a parting shot, a question that I want to ask you based on what you just said. I have heard many activists and many people within the movement say, why then focus on green and why then focus on clean? If we need that power, let's just use our core resources. Let's focus on development, because these forces beyond the continent are restricting us. Let's forget about this cleanliness. Let's get the power, and then we can think about greening. What would be your final thoughts on that narrative?
It's a logical narrative. First of all, the concept of kicking the ladder,
right,
is very much at play. Like I said, I gave you a description. I did that intentionally. When one of the most industrialized nations on the continent was casually, right, I can't call it coerced, casually asked to embark on a just energy transition plan. Right.
Which is now being threatened, but yes.
Yes. Which was initially targeted towards not using coal, right?
Mm.
And when the time came for that coal to be necessary to be used for heating in another jurisdiction, right?
Mm.
That jurisdiction did not take the high road to say, listen, whatever it is, we may freeze to death, but we're doing this for the planet. Okay. They did not choose to do that, right? And so no one can ever come with the authority of a moral ground to say, we can't compare ourselves to that jurisdiction. But the point is, who got us to where we are right now? Was it Africa? No. Henceforth, Africa can be the bigger person as it always has been. We have been slapped on the right and offered the left, right, multiple times, right? But it's okay. That's the good-naturedness of being African, right? They think we are dumb, but it is what it is. Being good-natured, you're always going to be seen as dumb. We remain the good-natured people, the good-natured species that ensures that we still listen, right, to the greater collective that is required. And so if stopping coal is to happen for the benefit of mankind, right, then my answer is accelerate in ensuring that we move away from coal. Support us in an accelerated manner. Don't be giving us conditionalities or loans, any benevolent forms of understanding tools or financing. We are not a basket case. We could easily, like you just say, we could easily focus on development and focus on that, right? If we get our act together, we could easily do that. But we won't, because we are good natured. So it's not that we should stop entirely to develop, but we are focusing on ensuring that our developmental path then also remains a green one. There will be, and the other option I always say is, when you say transition, transition is not starting and stopping. Even the word transit, you are going through somewhere to get somewhere. And for Africa, that going through somewhere, right, for certain jurisdictions, means going through usage of coal, usage of gas, usage of oil. It is not ideal. It is not what we are outrightly advocating for. But it's a transition. You can't say a transition is starting today, and I mean, stopping today and starting on something tomorrow. You have to have a transition. You start, you stop using this gradually, and you start using something gradual. Even if it means that gradual is at a peak, or should we say is a steep gradual process. But there's going to be graduation at some point. And so the focus on STEM, the focus on STEM, when I say the offshoots of value addition on the continent, right? STEM should not necessarily be focusing on value addition. It should be focusing on how to transition at minimum planetary cost, right? And I say that because they say there are parts of China that are living in 2050. I have seen some of these parts, right? Where you have autonomous drones that deliver food to your doorstep.
In traffic, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Right? Think about how that would be happening on the continent. Cars themselves are failing to drive autonomously on African roads, right? We don't even have enough road work, a road network.
Yeah, we must deal with the potholes first.
Right? We don't even get me started on potholes. But the point is, that STEM education that is an offshoot of all these value addition processes will mean we also get to, I mean, I'm not a soothsayer, but the process of science is such that there's always going to be one person who's going to think differently from the other, right? And that one person is going to bring out innovation, right? And hopefully, if we all focus on ensuring that that innovation is in continent, then we start having the ability to actually finance our own innovation, support our own innovation. Sometimes it's not even just finance that is required. We have geniuses that live on nothing but bread and water for 3-5 days before they have a breakthrough in a mathematical equation. I lived with one of those. I went to a very prestigious school where I saw geniuses in real life. Some of them are actually out there in the world running things, right?
It's true. They can be very humble.
Some are in Harvard, some are in Oxford, some are political scientists, some are actually scientists, right? But if you saw their thought processes when we were in high school, when we were in university, right? They were never thinking of money. Some of them are ridiculously wealthy, but they don't even look at that. All they want is progress. So sometimes you don't even think of, and that's why scholarships are a big thing for Africans, isn't it? Right? Free education when I'm in a developed jurisdiction, right?
But we get retained.
The MK, exactly.
There is, you know, the jewels you drop are, you have to be a returning guest. We have to call it for now. But before we get off the line, everybody who comes on the podcast has to justify why they are here on the basis of a metaphor. A jet. We are a jet. The Just Energy Transition podcast is a jet. And why, Mkululi, do you deserve to be aboard a first class jet of the Global South? Tell us.
I'm going to disappoint you in my response. I am not an individual who believes I'm any special. Hence, first class, I'm not sure. I am privileged to be in the jet. And that in itself is what I will stick with. So my privilege to be in the jet comes from thinking that I am on board with individuals who believe we can do things differently, but more importantly, we can do things on our terms, right? Here, I'm not just speaking in terms of Africa. People who have the same mindset, right, and believe in progression happening in a certain manner, right, should not be bound by physical jurisdictions. So I feel that JET is beyond the physicality of what, as a Pan-Africanist, people would think I'm speaking to. Right. We had Mia Motley at the AU summit, this past AU summit. Her description of what she wanted to see as Africa and its offshoots, right?
Mm-hmm.
As a person who was coming from the Caribbean, you realize that we should not be bound by thinking Africa is just Africa. We are the source and probably are going to be the last standing bastion of decent human progression, right?
MK, my good sir, that is a home run. Thank you all the way from Addis, representing at the AU. We are going to put all your links below for people to connect with you and the AU. But you have to come back. I haven't even asked you a tenth of the questions I wanted to. So we're going to call it. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for tuning into our JET podcast today. Before you disembark, don't forget to subscribe and stay connected. For more resources, updates, and ways to take action, visit jetvoices.com. Until our next JET flight, stay inspired, stay engaged, and keep pushing for a just energy transition.